Warning: The Savage Nation contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised. And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation, home of borders, language, culture. And here he is, Michael Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of The Savage Nation.
Well, here we are, the kickoff day. Let's go downfield together on The Savage Nation in the daytime slot, the primetime slot, 3 to 6 Eastern, 12 to 3 Western, and everything in between. As you well know, today is the first day of the rest of my radio life. And since so many people are other-directed with sports and travel and entertainment, we've decided to give you the best of the best, the Savage family stories over the years today. But remember this, tomorrow, January 2nd, it will be live all day long. By the way, the New York Daily News did a fabulous article on yours truly, Civilized Savage. He knows the issues and museums and music too. Well, if you think that's all it's about, then you don't know Michael Savage. Sit back and relax and listen to the best of the Savage Nation live tomorrow.
Savage.
Wait, I thought I told him about Herbie the Schlub. There's nothing to tell. He was a sad sack, worked in the coffee shop at Shanks. That's right. He had a mannerism of talking. He was a pudgy guy, worked in the coffee shop. But when you're a young kid who's a lowly busboy, even a guy who has a job in a coffee shop, you start to think he's somebody. It's like when you're 7 years old and you go to the movies alone and an usher had like a uniform on. You actually thought he was an officer of the law. Remember those days? When you're seven and a guy in the movie theater has a uniform on with epaulettes, you assume he's Napoleon's grandson and you listen to him. Today they take him and throw him in a dumpster. You don't listen to you, people in movies today don't listen to anybody. Oh, what fun we used to have throwing Good and Plenty at the screen on a Saturday. Who went for the movie? We threw popcorn up in the air just to see the Technicolor hit the popcorn. Oh, I had a miserable rat for a friend. Lives in Scarsdale, married a lawyer, hasn't worked in 20 years, the bum. Got white hair, thought he looked like Hemingway, really looked like an old man from the garment center who failed. But in his mind, he thought he was Hemingway, that type. You know the type? He thought he had a Hemingway-esque like look, that type always dressed nattily. But people looked at him, they thought he was a busted-out suitcase from the garment center. From day one, he's the one whose mother used to beat herself over the hands with the chain. And then when the father came home, she'd say, Sam, look what Johnny did to me. Look what your son. And the father and the son fought that family. I don't blame the kid. The family was nuts, but she was nuts because she went to a doctor in New Jersey to get Benzedrine shots in those days now, Hamburger Express and Pink Cadillac and all, in order to lose weight. So she came back like a speed addict, nuts. Everything was crazy. Took it all out on her growing, developing, crazy son. But we were good friends in those days. I'm just saying later on, a guy busted out at Fort Dix was always a loser on the streets of the garment center. And then he married a lawyer, moved to Scarsdale, and walked around with the white beard on Grand Central State. And he thought everyone thought he was Hemingway, when in fact he just looked like a guy from the garment center who was going to a 25-cent porno store, really, with a paper bag and a raincoat. But in his mind, he thought he was distinguished coming out of the porno shop, if you know what I'm talking about. But the reason I'm mentioning him is because I lost the entire story about Herbie. So I thought I'd twist it to him.
Savage.
Here's one of my favorite stories about my very tough two-fingered geometry teacher who allegedly lost his fingers. Well, listen and find out.
I had a geometry teacher in high school. He had two fingers on his right hand. He was a tough guy. He was an Irishman and real tough, but a very good teacher, and the kind of teacher who made you come up to the blackboard and perform at the blackboard, and if you didn't, he ridiculed you. He didn't curse you out, but he called you a dummy, basically. He says, now, what's the matter with you today, Michael? Is your brain not functioning? That kind of thing. And believe me, you didn't want to wind up in front of that class not knowing your stuff because you didn't want to be humiliated in front of your peers called your classroom. Now, today, they take every moron off the street, every idiot who has one eye going up, one eye going down, he can't talk, he can't see, he can't hear, and they tell you he's smarter than you are, and if you dare be smarter than him, you go to the back of the class. But in those days, it was very clear. If you were smart, you were smart. If you were stupid, you were dumb, and that was the end of it, and no one changed anything. So he had a left hand with five fingers and a right hand with two fingers, and the two fingers were stubs, but he could still put chalk on a board. And when he said to you, the midterm exams are back, he would read out every name and every score publicly. Now, why do you think he did it? Because he understood that by doing well, you were proud of yourself, and the kids looked up to you, and by doing poorly, you were ashamed of yourself, boys and girls, and you try to do better. But because the liberal perverts took over the schools, where they try to put perversion ahead of everything else, they have now taken dummies and try to make that better than the smarties. And consequently, the schools can't even teach Johnny how to add or read. And if Johnny's smart enough, and he can't focus at all, they put him on Ritalin to dope him up and turn him into a sissy and a dumbbell who can't do anything except sit in a cubicle the rest of his life and possibly jump off a building when he's 25. Now, how Mr. W. lost his fingers is another interesting story. We all knew about it very fast. I forget his full name. It was Mr. W. And it was whispered in the halls of the high school that he lost his fingers, and I'm not glorifying it, planting a bomb for the IRA. Now, I don't know whether it was true, but it was certainly enough to make us understand not to mess around with this teacher. And we didn't. We respected him. Whether it was true or not is irrelevant. That's who we had for teachers in those days. I've lived through some historic times in my life. You won't believe this. And here they are. Look what I have seen in my lifetime. I want to show you how long I've been around this planet so you're going to get a feeling of what I've seen in my lifetime. One, Superman defeated by every man in World War II. Two, the first atomic bomb used in warfare. The establishment of the State of Israel. The popularization of television. This is all in my lifetime. The popularization of air conditioning. The popularization of air travel. The popularization of the personal computer. The invention of the Internet. The assassinations of John F. Kennedy, Robert F. Kennedy, and Martin Luther King Jr. I've seen the first man walk on the moon. I've seen the complete integration of blacks and whites. I've seen the development of mass welfare for unproductive citizens. I've seen the destruction of America's judicial system by corrupt lawyers. I've seen the meltdown of America's borders. I've seen the self-genocide of America's European-American majority through a mass abortion and mass tolerance of diverse sexualities. I've seen the acceptance of narcotics. I've seen the debasement of religion. I've seen the takeover of corporations by gamblers and con men. I've seen the elimination of grades in many schools. I've seen the introduction of racial quota systems. I've seen the impeachment of a president. What will I see in the future? Well, that's for you to decide, not me.
Savage.
Mother Savage, I was talking with my audience about fond memories and things that influenced me. And I remember the day you took me and Alan to Radio City Music Hall. Do you remember here how radio was done behind the scenes?
Oh, sure.
You remember when they rattled the big piece?
The NBC tour.
The NBC tour.
Right.
And they show you with the horse's hooves to make it sound like a horse on a
Right.
And then they rattled a piece of metal to make it sound like thunder.
Right.
And then where did you take us to eat? Do you remember where you would take Alan and I to eat?
Oh, we went to the Automat.
No. Well, the Automat was one place. How about when you took us to the Floridian?
Oh, my God. That's right.
Remember they whipped
the Floridian, the Californian.
There, you see, you're in Florida and I'm in California. There was something there. But they whipped the eggs up. What I liked about it is you made eggs. I mean, I don't want to put you down or anything, but they were just eggs. They were flat like everyone else's eggs. But when you went into this place, they had a way to make the egg go up like in a pyramid.
They put something in the eggs to make it puffy.
You didn't inhale. What were you and Bill Clinton?
No, I didn't inhale.
You didn't inhale. And the president said that. Look what it did for him.
No, I never had any vices.
You never had any vices. But, Mom, what do you think?
All I did was eat food.
So you can eat anything, but what do you think is the secret to longevity?
What's the secret?
Yeah. Because you're an elder. You're 83.
Yeah, my case, what it is, I think.
What?
No sex.
No sex. Well, that in San Francisco is a sin, what you just said, because these people believe that the more sex you have is better.
Well, they're not 83.
No, you can't argue with that. So you think
not at all.
So in other words, if I have no sex for the rest of my life, I could eat French fries and hot dogs and I'll be okay.
I hope so.
It's not a bad trade-off, I'll tell you the truth. With the problems that sex brings in a person's life, I think I'd rather have French fries and frankfurters, to be frank with you.
Savage.
You're listening to a collection of Michael Savage's personal stories today on the Savage Nation. Remember, tomorrow, January 2nd, I am live right here on this station.
Join the Savage Nation. Call now, 855-400-SAVAGE, 855-400-7282. Savage.
These cold, wintry nights make me think of the perverted chestnut man outside the Museum of Natural History. Well, here's the story of the perv chestnut man.
Did I tell you about the chestnut man? I didn't tell you about the chestnut. Oh, there were a lot of crazy people in those days that were on the streets. Well, today they are too, but they're holding microphones and they're working for CBS. So, one of our subway rides, cold, nasty, miserable, snowy winter day slush, 11 years old, dressed up like smoke coming out of your mouth that was so cold, your face was red, your hands could freeze if you took a glove off. I loved that weather. So there was like a bimmy who sold chestnuts outside the, I used to love the Museum of Natural History. I loved the Mastodon, I liked the gem collection. I didn't know it in those days. It shaped a lot of my future to show you the greatness of our culture. When I go to the Museum of Natural History as a kid and I saw exhibits of a natural scene from the Fiji Islands with birds, little did I know that years later I would actually seek out that kind of thing in my life professionally. Shaped, no doubt in part, by the great cultural institution of the Museum of Natural History. Of course, this is all lost today on the Islamofascists and the TV generation and the Internet and iPod. I don't know what these children are going to become. What is their dream? What kind of dreams do these idiots have? I haven't any idea. It's very sad that children have no dreams, no nothing. They think everything's in, you know, like, oh, I'll give you another example. Oh, so the chestnut man, and I have another story from last night. I'm going to tell you the last night's story before the chestnut story. After work, I went on one of my one-hour walks around downtown San Francisco. I need to burn off energy. Hat tilted low, collar up, anonymous. No one knows me. Till I open my mouth and heads turn. So I don't say anything. So I like to go and look into restaurants and bars, and I like seeing people going home and the hustle and bustle. It's kind of a fun thing at the conclusion of the day for me to see that in this gorgeous, beautiful city of San Francisco. So one of the places I stop in is like this shishi hotel. It's got a bar scene. I like to see the hubbub and the scene. I never liked the bar scene when I was young, and I'm not in the bar scene, but I like to watch it sitting in the lobby. So I'm sitting in a lobby on a chair, and the bar thing is over there. Hundreds of people, I mean, the kids in their 30s are looking. Everyone's a 7 in there, which is actually why it's more fun. They probably go home with each other. 7s go home with each other. The 9s and 10s go home, you know, to psychopathic behavior. The 7s at least go home with each other because they don't think they're God. So it's a place packed with 7s, and I'm sitting in a chair outside in the lobby, and I'm watching the comings and goings. Every girl that comes through the lobby pulls out a cell phone, and even though they're alone, they're all looking in the cell phone, talking. They're making believe that they have somebody they're waiting for. That's the latest gimmick, and they think someone's buying into it, that if you pull out a cell phone, it means you missed the date's late, and you're there, and you're busy, and you're popular. And they're all staring in it like a text message. They're looking like inside a fortune teller's crystal to see if they can find a visage of the truth inside this little instrument in their hand is how it struck me. If I were like from another planet looking in, I said, what kind of madness is this? What kind of species is this that young females who are searching for husbands to settle down and have children are walking around with a device in their hand? Instead of talking to a man, they're talking to this device in their hand and looking at it and staring in it as though it's the Holy Grail itself. Now, to go back to the chestnuts in the open fire, we're outside the museum, freezing slush cold. And one of these bimmies is selling chestnuts on the, you know, and they're delicious. Man, they roast them out there. Do they still do that? I don't even know if they allow them anymore. And the guy, I'm with my friend, we're 11, and he turns out, he says to us, hey, you guy, he had talked a weird voice. He was a big guy. And he says, hey, you kids want to see pictures of girls? So right away, I knew he was a dangerous guy. So we play him along. Yeah. Where do you got those pictures? You kids, come with me. Come with me. It's only a subway ride. I'll show you those pictures. We didn't go with him, but we knew that he was a pervert. How did we know? Because we're allowed to ride the subway at 11 instead of being locked up behind a web page.
Savage.
My uncle owned a deli, a little deli on 14th Street. I never told you that story. He owned it for a short period of time. I was thrilled that I finally had someone in the food business. It was such a kick as a little kid to go into the, like your uncle owns a deli. It's like you get embarrassed as a little kid. Like you see, like before he had no apron on and he wasn't behind the counter, he was like a regular person. Then all of a sudden he's like an official as a kid. Kids see the world a different way. There's my uncle behind the counter. To you, if that guy, your uncle behind the counter with a white apron on, like he's like a cop or a teacher or like an authority because he can cut ham on a machine. Somehow he's part of the government if he's a kid. Your kids have a weird view of the world. Man, do we love going in there and getting like provisions. You know, when a relative would open a business, the way it was done, all the other family members would go in the first day and buy a lot of stuff for cash. Don't put it on credit and stiff them. Today you go in and put it on credit and stiff the relative. Yeah, buy $1,000, $10,000, and then give them a stiff job. That's the relatives today. Those days you went and you put hard cash down on your... They put the dollar bill. Remember the good dollar bill? The first dollar they put on them? It's a different world. The deli men had hairy, like hairy thing. I don't know how they grow hair on the outside of their hands. Men don't even have hair like that anymore. The hair is diminished from political correctness on men. Like, I have a hairy chest and a hairy back. It comes out of the ears and nose. But they had hair that grew, like, on the outside of the hand. Like, opposite the palm, the back of your hand. It was, like, scary, like ape men. Underneath white shirts, like, hair came out. There's no men around like that, unless they're from Iraq or something. I don't know where they come from, guys like that. That's how you know you're getting, like, older. Like, guys, like, they can get away with murder in their 20s. They still think they're kids. Yeah, I'm still young. I'm never going to die. Don't worry about it. I can party all night. 30, like, the belly starts, no matter what you do, abs, no such thing. Always a roll. First gray hairs, pluck them out. Here they come again. That's it. And that the 30s are very hard. You ask any guy, those are the toughest years on earth. 40 is nothing ready. You know you're going to get flabby and die. 50, you look forward to being flabby and dying. At 60, you can't wait to... No, that's the way it works. The 30s are terrible because you're still trying to hold on to youth.
Remember, tomorrow, I am live right here on this station.
Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of The Savage Nation.
I've mentioned my friend's dad, the shady podiatrist, and his kid, the Anglophile, and his Jaguar XK150 on The Savage Nation.
It is The Savage Nation. Let me tell you the story of the shady podiatrist whose kid became an Anglophile, who crashed my Jaguar. But first, we have to listen to Stan Getz and Charlie Byrd. Stan Getz and Charlie Byrd on The Savage Nation, Desafinado, to set the mood and the time. Oh, I know what you're expecting, but you're not going to get it from me. You'll have to go to one of the other talk show hosts to get... Obama's a Marxist, and McCain is a war hero. If that's what you want from now until November, you're in the wrong, you're on the wrong dial position. It's over. Leave me alone with it already. I really don't care anymore. I'll talk to you about it after the election. That is, unless there's a revelation here now. It's enough already. Can we get on with our lives instead of focusing on these narcissistic egomaniacs who want to crash the country into the rocks even further? Please, listen to Desafinado, would you, by Stan Getz and Charlie Byrd. And I will tell you the story of the shady podiatrist whose kid became an Anglophile who crashed my Jaguar. So as the music fades away, I want to take you back in time to a childhood story. Of course, it's a teenage story at this point. I had a friend whose father was a shady podiatrist, as you can tell by the title of the story. And he had a weird podiatry practice in the back of his apartment in, I think it was Sunnyside, Queens, somewhere in that area. I have no idea what the man did in the back. He was a very strange father. Everybody was afraid of the guy. You'd go, and he was very tall. The father was very tall. He dressed kind of shabbily, but upscale, but it was all tattered. And he always had a weird look on his face. And when the father was not in the apartment, the son, who became the Anglophile later on to cover up his origins, would take you in his father's podiatry studio, clinic, or whatever it was, office. And he'd say with a snicker, "I want you to see my father's rack," where he stretched people or something. And there was always something weird about this guy's podiatry practice. I don't even know what a podiatrist did. Something to do with the feet, but I think this guy did something with another part of the anatomy by implication. Now you speed the clock up. The son who grows up in the shady apartment with a shady father, who was off-beaten, guy didn't become a real doctor, has to, throw dirt on his origins. So he becomes more Brooks Brothers than anybody we know. He adopts an English accent, and... the last I heard, he had married a rich girl, oh, this is a long time ago, and became a banker with the umbrella and the whole deal. Now, there's another element to the story of the shady podiatrist whose kid became an Anglophile, which is my Jaguar XK150. Prior to the time that he became a pure Anglophile, he was still my friend, but that's before I left New York. And I had an XK150 Jag that I'll never forget. I loved that car more than, well, most cars. Who remembers what car you love and this and that? But when I say I love that car, you got to remember something. We're limited by our language, English. English has one word for love. I love my car. I love my mother. I love my wife. I love my dog. I love this pizza. I love my new shoes. We're stuck with one verb. In Latin, there are 16 verbs for love, each one slightly more descriptive depending upon the type of love we're talking about. So when I say I love the Jaguar, it's not like I love my dog or any of the other things I mentioned. Well, one night we're partying in the podiatrist's son's apartment. The father, I think, was taking advanced rack stretching lessons somewhere in the Grenada. And as kids would do, we got drunk and probably some other things were used at the party, who knows what. And he said, hey, can I drive your Jag? It must have been 2 o'clock in the morning. And you know, you're a kid. Yeah, here's the keys. So he takes the car out on Queens Boulevard, 2 o'clock in the morning in Queens. And, you know, he raced it out as fast as he could go. And his heart's pounding. He's sitting at a traffic light after, you know, he did this long run. The light's red. He stopped. All of a sudden, he looks in this tiny 2-inch mirror that the Jags came with, and he sees a car careening right at the rear of the car. But before he could get the car in first, clutch it, gear it, and get out of there, crash, bang, boom, smashed in. The back of the car is broken off. And, of course, I've reversed the story. I think it was his Jaguar, and I was driving it, and I got hit from the rear. I really don't remember at this point whose car it was, but I do know who hit us. To this day, and I'm not making this up, you know, I know the guy's name. I remember it. He was an Iraqi. I swear to you. It was very odd, because I didn't know of Iraqis at that time. But he was an Iraqi national with a pure. His name was not Saddam Hussein, I know that. Nor was it one of the junior Husseins. But it was an Iraqi national who crashed the Jaguar and broke its back. And, of course, that was that. Our friendship ended soon thereafter. Yes, it was his car. He came and saw it, and the back was broken off the car, and he started to almost cry. He didn't cry like a sissy, but he wept. And he said, you broke the back of my car. I said, I didn't mean it. I was sitting there. And that's the story of the shady podiatrist whose kid became an Anglophile. Now play Desafinado, and I'll tell you why I told you that story. Actually, the song has more meaning to me than the story, because I remember when this song came out. I don't know if I can tell that story. Is that illegal? One of the girls in the crowd had a sister who was a Playboy bunny. She was older. She must have been 22. We were 17, 18, 19. Now, I want to tell you, Playboy bunny then was a Playboy bunny. Today, it has no meaning. Today, they look like skanks from the lowest levels of the sewer. I mean, you watch that show with that old degenerate bum. I mean, this guy should be... Let's just stop right there. I never saw anything like these skanky broads he has in that mansion of his. What is so interesting about these low-life bimbos he has with him? But in those days, a Playboy bunny was really something. I mean, they were the top of the heap. At least that's how guys saw her. Who knows what they really were? They're probably like every other woman on earth. You know, if they had a good figure, they became a Playboy bunny. As long as they did the right producer meet, you know. Well, this song was very popular at that time, you see, and she was 22, and everybody in the crowd wanted to get next to the Playboy bunny. But I was the lucky one that penetrated the ovum. And on the way home from that particular event, which, of course, I was flying high, I couldn't believe it, I was not in the Jaguar. I was in another car. I was in a Chrysler, which had the Hemi engine, but it was not whatever. It was a Chrysler New Yorker, an old man's car, but it had the Hemi engine. So I'm driving home from that encounter with the Playboy bunny. And remember, I'm really only a kid. And my mind was certainly not in the car. I mean, where was it? I have no idea. My mind was on cloud nine. Bang, hit from the side by a truck. The car is absolutely totaled. I got to get a tow truck. It's towed home to in front of the house. And I remember selling the car for the engine alone to some hitter kid who was going to take the engine out. We had a long talk about it and use it in a dragster.
Savage.
What else do you want me to talk about? How about me going on to a new website last night, Google Earth? It's beyond comprehension, Google Earth. You can punch in every address you've ever lived at in your life, which I did after, you know, it was Thanksgiving weekend with the family. My son said, Dad, you got to see Google Earth. So we sat there last night. I was blown away. I can't believe in heaven after this. There is no heaven. I mean, there's nothing. I don't know if I believe in anything anymore. I think I become an atheist instantly. I'm kidding. It's just astounding to go on this thing. It's frightening in a way.
It destroys your perspective of your uniqueness as an individual. Let me explain it. I go on this site, Google Earth. You can punch in any address. The globe spins. The next thing you know, it's like zooming down to the Bronx where I lived on a street when I was a kid. Then I punch in Hawaii, and then the globe turns, and suddenly the satellite image picks up a house I lived in Hawaii. Then it zooms back to California to the places I'm in. And I said, this is unbelievable to me. There's no privacy left. But then I thought, if a commercial site like Google Earth can hone in on anyone's address on Earth, I'm sure that governmental spy satellites can penetrate buildings with imagery. That's a given. Because this definitely came from the Defense Department a few years ago. They must have latched on to governmentally developed web technology, satellite technology, excuse me, to have gotten this. What do you want to talk about? Google Earth, should it be closed down? Answer yes. Any sane nation would close down Google Earth immediately. But then since the congressmen and senators are so out of touch with reality, they don't even know what Google Earth is. They know our restrooms on various highways around their districts. They know that they have on their maps. Because in restrooms, you can pick up bags of cash. That's all they need. Maybe they can use Google Earth to better target the pickup spots. That might be the reason they don't want to close it down. San Antonio, Joe, you're on the Savage Nation.
Hello. I was an infantry company commander in Iraq from 2003 to 2004. I can go on Google Earth, pull up the two base camps I lived at, and target every tent and building the soldiers lived in.
So you agree with me that this is very dangerous to release into the public?
It's ridiculous for the public to have access to this.
Now, here I am, a talk show host. I know this. In other words, I go on the site last night, okay, for the first time. Immediately I say this is insanity. How come it takes me to figure this out? Where is Mr. Chertoff, head of Homeland Security? Where's the great Donald Rumsfeld? Where are the generals? Are they out? Don't they know what's going on, Joe?
I showed this to my boss, and he showed it up the chain. It amazes me. Everything we built is available for anyone to look at. I can give it to my mortarmen. They say they can target every building with that information.
Oh, my God in heaven. Well, Joe, maybe I'll do some good by pointing out common sense here. You know, it takes... I've come to understand that maybe... I don't know how to put this without sounding completely arrogant. I don't know how to put this. I really am at a loss for words. They are so out of touch with reality, the leaders of our country, as witness the border situation, which we've been screaming about. I haven't for 10 years. Others have been doing it for longer. Believe me. Finally, Bush gives a tepid, little, too little, too late speech, thinking that we're going to go along with it, you know, with the cheers. I don't believe so. But let's talk brass tacks here. You got Google Earth. It can target any building, any tent, any facility in the world. It can be used to mortar any tent, any facility, any building in this country, including anyone's home. That would be any senator, any congressman, any talk show host, any lawyer. This is in the national interest to close down Google Earth. Tell the gel-haired billionaires to stop it now. Shut them down.
Remember, tomorrow, January 2nd, I am live right here on this station.
Savage.
Now remember, tomorrow, January 2nd, I, Michael Savage, will be here live. So be here or be nowhere. Many of you heard me talk about vitamins and diet. Well, here's my story of the horrible diet I had as a child, the Savage Childhood Diet.
Here was the diet of the young Savage. Now, mind you, it was meant because the parents came from a relatively, you know, impoverished background. I am very proud of that. Because they rose up. So what do poor people do when they get a little money? They feed themselves, and they feed themselves holiday foods three times a day. Everything that they would eat at a holiday when they were children, they gave their children for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. So a typical breakfast would be ham and eggs, maybe four eggs, maybe a brick of ham. I'm not talking a slice. I'm talking Canadian bacon size, the size of your, at least your pinky. Ham and eggs, dripping the eggs. Glass of milk, yet I had the 12 ounces of milk, and then a jelly donut to go to school with. Immediately, I had narcolepsy. The minute I hit the classroom, zzz. Michael, what is, 2 plus 5? I had no idea. It was a drowsy. Thank God it snowed in my face. It woke me up just on the walk to school. But the minute I got there and took off the scarf, I got so drowsy from the heaters in the school, I went right to sleep. The next thing I knew, someone shook me, and it was lunchtime. Lunchtime Ring, ring, lunchtime, recess, meatloaf sandwich from the night before, some type of potato dish that was congealed in order for travel, for eating in haste. Some kind of type of congealed potato dish that was stuck together like with mortar, you know, beaten with a mortar and pestle with some kind of glue. It wasn't just a potato, you know, which is good for you. What the, glued potatoes. That was it. That was dinner, 5 o'clock, the early show. And there I was in front of the TV with a tray and steak, French fries, ice cream. And poor dad would come in the door around. I was still eating at 6 o'clock, mind you. He came home gray from the winter, from working, from worrying over his son who was going to become everything that he hated. And my mother's like slaving over catering. Seriously, I'm just telling you point blank what the upbringing. He comes in white from the day. And I see his eyes dart right over to the empty tray, steak, the leftover fries. I was like the young King Farouk in the making. I was on the ice cream pour. Yeah, Ma, I'll have another one. All right, get me a kitchen and knock. Go get me another one. Oh, we were terrible kids, so spoiled. Because they wanted some food like that. What are you waiting on? All right, you're coming to work with me on Saturday. No, Dad, I don't want to go down in that basement. Yeah, you're going to clean bronzes again. You and the Bowery Bum, I pay 75 cents a week. You're going to go down there with the, and you'll clean those bronzes, and you'll know what it is to be a man. I'm looking at clothes you wear out here, you and your friends. What do you mean, Dad? We're just wearing clothing that is not black or gray. Never mind. Ah, come on, I go on and on. And it's absolutely true. And that's the way it was. Okay, but the point of the story is this went on for years and years and years. Now, if I were conducting human experiments and it was legal, I wouldn't do it to anybody. But if I wanted to conduct an experiment on what causes early death from coronary artery disease, that diet would be the model. That would be the epidemiologic model. You'd take somebody and put them in a prison, and you'd feed them the exact diet three times. For 5 years, you could induce a heart attack in a seven-year-old, I think, with that diet. So there must be a little bit more to it. You understand that there's got to be three parts to any disease pattern. Diet or the environment, genes, and then there's another factor. There's whatever else you do. And a little luck thrown in the unknown. As I'm still ticking along here. Thank God I caught on to it young. Thank God I went to, you know, I left New York. I looked for the Fountain of Youth. I did the Ponce de Leon thing. And I investigated nutrition early on. First nutrition book I ever read was George Osawa's Zen Macrobiotics, the number 12 diet, brown rice. There's a diet that it will definitely give you longevity, but you don't want it. There's no reason to live. When you hit the number 12 diet, and they all got sick anyway, it was all a lie. All the guys who practiced those extreme diets, they all died of like liver cancer at 40. You ever noticed how many guys who were, oh yeah, I'm a vegetarian years ago, a runner, they're all dead. The purists, I never touch animal products, I don't eat any fish, fowl, nothing from the sea, I do not touch dairy, I'm a lacto-ovo, humanitarian, vegetarian, unitarian, I absolutely don't touch it. You know, in a number 12, I live on a rice diet, rice-based, soy-based, and usually a liver cancer struck them, or hepatitis, somehow, from, I don't know, from maybe kissing the girls with mustaches they got, I have no idea. Hanging around in dirty health food stores could do it to you too.
Warning, The Savage Nation contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised. And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation, home of borders, language, culture. And here he is, Michael Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of The Savage Nation.
Well, here we are, the kickoff day. Let's go downfield together on the Savage Nation in the primetime slot, 3 to 6 Eastern, 12 to 3 Western, and everything in between. And since so many people are other-directed with sports and travel and entertainment, we've decided to give you the best of the best, the Savage family stories over the years today. But remember this, tomorrow, January 2nd, it will be live all day long. One of the best ways for you to get to know me is through my stories, my famous stories. Love by the Sewer Plant. People always call and ask me to hear that one. Well, here is Love by the Sewer Plant.
Savage.
We're talking a sewer plant.
We're talking about Love by the Sewer Plant. First Love by the Sewer Plant. Now, this girl was so beautiful that the, like, it was like summer stock. Turn that on. They can't listen to me in the music. They got the mood already. We said it. In other words, this is a small hotel, like, you know, nothing fancy. The owner was a former boxer, a pugilist. He was the one where I told you that Jackie, who worked at the hotel, got thrown in the pool. I don't remember the name of the hotel. But he was a tough guy, this guy, genuinely tough guy. And that if he got into an argument with anyone who worked for him, he beat them up and threw them off the property, that type. Everyone was terrified of him. Old school, New York Jewish kind of street fighter type. So he ruled this little hotel that he had like with an iron thumb, an iron whatever, iron boot. He was a tough guy, and the things ran right. Nothing ever went wrong. No one robbed cutlery. No one talked back. So anyway, I'm a kid. There's a kid there, and boom, it's Love by the Sewer Plant across down the thing in the river by the Neversink River. The water was so cold that when you waded across it, your feet turned blue. I'll tell Love by the Sewer Plant, but starting with the Shabup Shabup again. They don't understand this. How could the audience follow my brain? I got to make them follow. How to explain to them? All right. Okay, turn it off now. It's 56-57, Plymouth Fury, 59. My uncle had a Plymouth Fury, I think. I'm not sure. Somewhere around then. Outside one of the hotels in the Catskill Mountains. I'm still young, 15. I don't know how old I was, something like that. So, fall in love, first love by the Sewer Plant. Here's how it is. This girl was so stunningly gorgeous, like just really beautiful, that the theater companies would come through. They had like an entertainment in these hotels, like they call it a casino. At night they'd have entertainment. Sometimes they'd have a comedian who was terrible, a juggler, a balloon man, who then eventually the father of the guy who went on XM or Sirius. His father was a balloon man, allegedly, who went around making pornographic images with balloons, as the son does verbally. Things like that. In other words, schlocky entertainment. So, nevertheless, they thought they were artists. Like, you got to understand that. Even though they were schlocky entertainment, let's say they could paint in velvet paintings, they're still a painter. In their mind, they're Van Gogh. They were theatrical, and everyone else was bourgeois, you know. The other people ate the borscht, and they ate the chave. In other words, they were the artistes, so they understood. So, in other words, some of these entertainers came around, and they looked at this girl, and they came running up. I was holding her hand and walking with her. We were kids. And they said, Manny, I wanted you to see this girl. This is the girl I was telling you about. And they, like, looked at her like she was a specimen of, you know, like, biblical beauty. So, to make a long story short, it's just Young Love by the Sewer Plant. And what I meant was, where are you going to go when you're a kid? You got nowhere to go. So, we took a walk down the hill, down the hill, down the hill, down the hill, down the hill. Jack and Jill went down the hill. And it was a long slope down to the Neversink River. And there was a sewer treatment plant, which occasionally, as you well know, with sewer treatment plants, they're not exactly, they don't smell that good. But kids don't care. They can override anything, particularly when the lust hits them. So the two kids walk down the hill, they cross the river, and their feet, they roll up the dungarees, take off the shoes, the legs are blue, and they have a little moment of passion together. And it was his first moment of passion. It was not exactly on the level of a complete moment of passion, but for him it was the first of that type. So now the kid is starstruck. I'm walked like stars in his eyes after that. There were not enough stars in the sky that night in the black sky and the billions of stars to equal the passion that he had for the world, where he thought he could literally reach out, grab a star, and fly away. That's how phenomenal he felt as a youngster. But then, of course, as you well know, nothing like that lasts. So what I'm getting at with the story is that it was by a sewer plant, and there's nothing more to it, and boom, and now play some John Coltrane, because there's no more to the story that I care to tell, because if I do, it'll become a pantomime, and I don't want to embarrass myself with a pantomime of something that was quite beautiful.
Savage.
Dallas, Texas. Devin, you're on the Savage Nation topic, please.
I want to hear the story about your mother when she was, I believe, living in a retirement home, and she complained about the food was so horrible, and she wanted you to arranged to have special food brought in, sent in, and you found out later that the food was great, and she was just trying to put a guilt trip on you.
You remember the story better than I do. Look, she got born in the nursing home, whatever they call it, assisted living. In my day, it was called an old age home. Now they call it assisted living, you know. All right, so she's in the home. It was a lovely place in Florida. I don't mean like, let's say, in The Sopranos at that level. It was, you know, in reality, let's say if that was a 10, this was an 8. She was in a home like an 8. Food was perfectly fine, but she, you know, she was a woman who liked her own food in her own ways. So I'd say from a distance, Mom, what can I do to help you? She says, can you get me Chinese food or Italian? That's all she said toward the end. So I went through contortions.
I called a local Chinese place who didn't. I said, well, Ma, can't you just call a Chinese place and have them deliver and put it on my credit card? No, she said, they don't deliver. Well, I said, call an Italian joint down there in Delray. I said, they'll deliver. No, no one delivers. I went through a machination. I called a taxi company. I got a nice guy, Jake. He said, yeah, I'll do it for your mother. I don't know who you are. You sound like a nice guy. I'll drive. I'll get the food. I said, all right, charge me the cab fare plus $15. I did this for weeks that I delivered Chinese and Italian. And I found out weeks later that they delivered from the same restaurant. She was doing it just to work me over, God bless her. Another guilt trip that somehow I look, that's how they like children in the end. I could just imagine what I'll be if I live. Oh, but I don't think anyone will take care of me the way I did my mother. Nah. Well, I think I'm more like my father. I don't know how long I want to live and how long I will live. It's really not in my hands up to a certain point it is. But I'm nowhere near that. I mean, although sometimes I'm thinking of checking into an assisted living for one reason. See, the radio business is very lonely. You're alone 99% of the time. Then you're on the radio. You're like a nut talking into a microphone. I wouldn't be bad. You could argue over things there. And you get up at 5 in the morning, there's always a coffee cup. There's people to like. There's people to hate. You know, when she was in that home, the assisted living place, it was very nice. Next door was a man 50 years old, a doctor. Would you believe it? He lost his mind. He was in there at 50, a big guy, like a freak. He was frightening looking. I was afraid he'd kill her. Every time I came in there, he was like a Frankenstein came out of his room. Something happened. His mind went on him. And they wound up putting him in this joint. He never heard a fly. No, I was afraid one day, like, pick up a cleaver and kill everyone in the home there. But there were men as young as 50 in some of these places that to the outside eye, to the unaided eye, looked perfectly normal. But I don't know. They checked in there. There's nothing to do in those places. But as you start to deteriorate, they move you up in floors. If you're on the floor 3, you're still good, 2 and 3. 4 already you're going in the head. 5 already you're babbling on, you're like, blah. And 6 already you're in the Alzheimer's ward, there's nothing left upstairs. So the fear was to be moved up by floor. My mother used to say, I'm not going, that's terrible. She didn't want to go floor, poor mom. She didn't want to go up by floors. She didn't.
Savage.
I used to be an amateur photographer. I told you I stopped taking pictures because I got bored with the digital. But now my son sent me a present of a through-the-lens, an SLR digital. So I went around, and I started some pictures. San Francisco's finest bums. Now, there's one of a homeless guy lying in a doorway in San Francisco. And I've seen this guy around for years. I have a pet theory that he may be God, sent to the earth to test people, how they react to him. He's an older guy, very gentle, absolutely gentle, and he doesn't panhandle. In fact, I once offered him money or food. He said, I don't need it, thank you. So I told my assistant once as we walked by, I said, this guy could be God. Why is it not possible that God didn't come down once in a while? Isn't it possible God comes down once in a while in a body, in a human form, to test people? Just check out, you know, his creation. His creation called man. To see what they're doing. See if he wants to destroy it with, like, earth, with a flood or an earthquake. Now, where else would God go to test it out but San Francisco, whether to hit it with an earthquake? You got to be careful here because it's like Santa Claus. He wants to see how you treat him, you know.
Join the Savage Nation. Call now, 855-400-SAVAGE, 855-400-7282. Savage.
Well, welcome to the Savage Nation. I'm Michael Savage, the host of the famous Savage Nation show. So you've got a real treat today. We're playing a collection of my family stories today. So sit back and relax. Fat Al's Tuna is one of the most popular stories of all time. Well, here it is. Now, Fat Al's Tuna, that's a recipe. When I was a boy working as a busboy in the Shanks Paramount Hotel, I saw how tuna was really made. Fat Al was a 350-pounder. Now, when he made tuna in a tureen, he didn't use a mixed mass. They used his hairy forearm. He had his cigarette dangling from the right side of his mouth, and the kitchen was banging and bustling, and the people were out there eating a ninth meal of the afternoon. And he was mixing a tuna. He would throw the cans of tuna in. They'd throw in vats of mayonnaise. And the guy stirred it with his arm. He rolled up his undershirt. You see, you got to visualize this. Fat Al would lean over that tureen with the arm, the big, giant Italian arm, full of hair. And his arm was mayonnaise thick up to his armpit. And he's got the arm moving around. And he said, you see, kid, you keep moving it till you get a nice creamy consistency. Meanwhile, the ash is falling off his cigarette. I guess that helped the taste of the tuna because the people never complained. They loved it. Now, that's a tuna. There is a proper tuna with a little sweat and arm hair. Now, that is a good tuna fish recipe.
Other than that, I don't want to talk about recipes.
Savage.
Brave men near death who see with blinding sight. Blind eyes could blaze like meteors and be gay. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. And you, my father, there on the sad height. Curse, bless me now with your fierce tears, I pray. Do not go gentle into that good night. Rage, rage against the dying of the light.
Dylan Thomas, do not go gentle into that good night. And that was his voice. The guys found the recording of him. What an incredible, incredible reading. Incredible reading. Do not go gentle into that good night. I'll never forget when I went to Queens College as a kid who had never read a poem in his life. Never. I went to a high school where poetry wasn't taught, and we thought that anyone who wrote poetry or read poetry was less than a man, let's put it to you that way. So we didn't read it. I didn't know about it. I didn't go to a private boarding school where the drugs were cheaper and boys learned how to sleep with boys. You'll have to forgive me. I went to a public high school. I worked in a store after school, and I studied as best as I could. But the fact is, when I went to Queens College, I had to take English 101 like everybody. And I walk into English 101, and there is this white-haired, blue-eyed, I never forget as long as I live. You know, classically Anglo professor, and he was very manly, but not overly bearing, oppressively so. And he read poetry, and he read it in a voice very much like Dylan Thomas. He made me understand the power of words in a way I had never understood. Words could have power in a different way, let's put it that way. I always knew words had power as a little boy. I know that you fought over certain words and you didn't fight over other words. Words can make you laugh, words can make you cry. I knew that certainly by the time I could read and write. Long before I could read and write, I knew the power of words. Now, the fact of the matter is sticks and stones may break my bones, but names will never harm me. I understand all that too. But that's about the extent of the poetry I knew until I got into Queens College. And then a world opened up for me. When I heard English poetry read by that professor to us proletariat boys and girls in Queens College. And that world has never closed to me. And although I'm living in an increasingly idiotic, debased, uneducated, doltish America, where education is frowned upon, education is doubted, when you look at the morons in the media, and particularly in the entertainment world, uneducated high school dropouts one after the other, whether it be Gwyneth Paltrow or that comedian who cursed black guys, every one of them, every last one of them, fundamentally what you're looking at is white trash. You're looking at white trash. That's what you're looking at. What do you think you're looking at? What, because they have money, they're not white trash? You never heard of it? You don't know how it can apply to somebody with money? Believe me, it can apply to somebody with money. What do the words white trash mean when you analyze it? If you look it up in the dictionary, there's actually a phrase, white trash. It means a person who either by birth or by station in life is in the, I think how it's written, it's very interesting writing. It's either a person either by birth or by station in life, by birth or by lack of education and station in life, is at the lower rungs of society, basically. Now, unfortunately, many of them are in the entertainment business. Many of them are very good looking. But when I see somebody going on television, I got to listen to them on Larry King saying they just came out of rehab. What I say is, white trash, next case. I don't care how good her legs are. I don't care how good her Botox lips look like. White trash, next. Let me see the next channel. I don't want to hear about another white trasher who went to rehab.
Savage.
A red diaper doper baby derives from a well-worn phrase called red diaper baby. A red diaper baby was a child raised by communist parents, predominantly in New York City, primarily in Brooklyn. Parents who were steeped in communism, raised their children with communist philosophy, hated America through and through, and even went so far as to take their little red brats and send them to communist youth camps in the Pocono Mountains. This is all real. It's established. It was done in the 50s and 60s. They were known as red diaper babies. They were raised on the Ethel and Julian Rosenberg fantasy that they were innocent victims of American plutocracy when in fact they were atomic spies who deserved to be executed. So those are red diaper babies. Now I try to understand how these red diaper babies have become so virulent in their viral hatred of America. And I added it up and I figured out marijuana has poisoned their mind to the extent that their brain is so warped that they would rather hate a conservative like me. They'd rather hate George Bush than Ahmadinejad, who said he will kill them. That's a red diaper doper baby.
Remember, tomorrow, live, right here on your local station, the first of the new Savage Nation.
Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of The Savage Nation.
Now remember, tomorrow, January 2nd, I, Michael Savage, will be here live. This is the most requested tale of my childhood. Dead Man's Pants. Yes, I wore Dead Man's Pants. We were that poor.
Savage.
Of all the people I run into once in a while, they say, you know, I loved your childhood stories, and the most interesting one to me was Dead Man's Pants. So now, ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, Dead Man's Pants. Growing up in the Bronx as I did, the man child in the promised land, I didn't have many of the luxuries most kids with their hats on back would take for granted today. My father was an immigrant. He worked his fingers to the bone. We simply didn't have the money to afford more than the basics, so as you might expect, I cherished and took care of the things I had. As a kid, I'd line up my shoes under my bed at night, neat, like in the military. I made sure they were polished, too. I'm sure some shrink today would say I suffered from ADD or other compulsive behavior disorders and should have been put on a regimen of drugs. I wonder what they say about the fact that through most of my youth I wore secondhand pants from dead men. Many of the pants I wore as a preteen came off of stiffs cut down to fit me. Now, don't get me wrong. My father was a good man. He ran a small antique store with mostly 19th century stuff. On the side, at least in the beginning, he sold used goods as well. A man's got to do what a man's got to do to make ends meet, right? Occasionally, he would go to an auction after a man died and buy the entire estate. The clocks, the dishes, the mirrors, whatever the man had. The pants, the shirts, the whole deal. You get the picture? Back at the store, as he sorted the stuff for resale, he'd take a closer look at the suit. Once he got a hot shafter and mark suit from a dead man. Now, what's he going to do? Toss it in the garbage like they do today? In those days, it wasn't in him to throw out a good worsted fabric. Instead, he brought home the pants to me. I remember my father called me to the bedroom and showed them to me like the head tailor at Nordstrom's department store. He'd say, now, Michael, get a good look at the fabric. I wanted to vomit. I got a migraine because I knew what was coming. Take a look at the quality of this fabric. He's working me like a salesman. He's unrolling the pants on the bed. I can see it to this day. He unrolls it like he's selling me a bolt of hand-woven cloth. He would say, you can't get fabric like this anywhere. I wanted to say, of course not, Dad. They only sell stuff like that for men who died. You know, it was like special clothing for the undertaker. Even if I had said something, that wouldn't have changed one thing. He'd go downtown and the pants would come back fit for me. You know, shortened without the legs taken in properly. I'm sorry. They ended up baggy like an Abbott and Costello pair of pants. I'm sorry. They ended up baggy like an Abbott and Costello pair of pants. Even if they had fit me properly, there was something repugnant about the whole idea. Like I said, I knew how to make do with whatever was at hand. There's an old saying, the man with no shoes complains until he meets the man with no feet. The fact that I didn't have much more than a place to sleep in my first little apartment after college was okay with me. At least I wasn't wearing dead man's pants. Little did I know that one day those awful pants would serve as a metaphor for the shift in my political orientation. You might find it interesting that I wasn't always an independent conservative. I was raised a Democrat, blue-collar home. My dad was a Democrat. My mom was a Democrat. Most of my relatives still vote Democrat. To an immigrant family whose parents came of age during the Great Depression, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt was the great white savior. Aside from being the only U.S. president reelected to office three times, he gained lasting political mileage with the relief that his New Deal offered. As you might expect, then, my father used to tell me, Michael, all I know is the Democrats are for the little guy and the Republicans are for big business. In a way, his attempt to sell me on the political leanings of the Democrat Party was no different than his sales job with the dead man's pants. He was selling me a failed ideology that should have been buried long ago. So as a young man, not seeing things as clearly as I do now, I voted as my dad did, since I didn't understand politics. But as I grew older, that view would change completely. The turning point in my thinking can be traced back to my first job out of college as a social worker in the Upper West Side of New York. All of my so-called clients were minorities. Now, I was a good liberal at the time, having had my brain washed at one of the city universities in New York by a whole slew of European immigrants who, instead of kissing the ground when they got here, urinated on the sacred soil and the flag and immediately sought to instill communist philosophy in the minds of the young, myself included. I didn't know that at the time. I was just a wide-eyed liberal kid with an eye on changing the world. there I was, fresh out of Queens College. Having minored in sociology, I figured I'd take a job as a social worker to save the, quote, oppressed minority. I was always an idealist. I still am, as a matter of fact. But the abuses of the welfare system that I saw back then nauseated me and started me on my slow road to recovery. Day after day, I found person after person who was working, who had a job, but who claimed they didn't so they could get their government handout. Worse, they knew they were ripping off the welfare system and didn't bat an eye. How could I be so sure these hucksters weren't swindling Uncle Sam? I mean, you could argue that they were oppressed and didn't know the rules. Not me. At a young age, I learned a valuable lesson on how to spot people who smiled to your face while robbing you blind the second your back was turned.
Savage.
I don't like cutesy. I don't like people who talk to their children cutesy. It makes me squirm. Have you heard these parents talk to their children with, like, cute talk? That's why the child winds up psycho. You know, I got to tell you a little trick about child rearing. In my opinion, one man's opinion, and I haven't done so bad. Speak to them as you would an adult, and they will grow up more intelligent, and they will be more competent younger. You ever listen to the people with the children? I love the ones who take them to a restaurant and give them a lesson in front of you to show how smart they are, how smart the child is with the pencils and the coloring book. You're spending $29 for a plate of spaghetti that costs 4 cents, and there they are next to you. The guy with the ponytail, he's 63, with a 30-year-old girl he met somewhere at a club. And right away, a year later, they have the 2 years later, they have the baby, and 4 years later, ready the coloring book and the crayons in the pasta palace. And they're all set up. They got the whole thing. They got the backpack. They got the diaper at your next table. And they got the coloring book and the crayons, which should be outlawed in restaurants. It's not ding-dong school. Not everything is a ding-dong school. There was a time, and I raised children. I wasn't allowed in certain restaurants with the children when they were young. I didn't like it. But I understood it. People didn't want to be disturbed by children. Now, if they get sued, if they say to the people, you know what, we'd rather you not change doo-doo at the table, right away they call ACLU, and a lawyer like an ACLU, like a smarter one than an ACLU lawyer, the brother who went into private practice with the same mentality. Marvin goes into the ACLU because he's stupid, and Barry goes into the private practice and sues, but they're the same mentality. Two heads of the same hydra. That's it, the coloring books in the restaurant. How do you spell Louisiana, Louise? Very good. And then the mother claps at the desk. Yeah, this is where you're sitting having a romantic meal. $29.95 for the pasta al ripofo, antipasto consisting of a piece of old rotten cheese from Brooklyn that they couldn't sell to the Italians in New York because they know better, so they ship it to San Francisco. That's $9.95 for one little piece of mozzarella cheese and a tomato. They give it an Italian name. $9.95 with a tomato and one little piece of cheese that the Italians rejected on the wharf. Even the wharf rats rejected it, but they can sell it in San Francisco. And $29.95 for pasta al creato. I don't mind it, all right, but you're going in for the ambience. No one's there for the food. They're in for the ambience. But the coloring book is there right away. And the lessons you have to listen to. Do you ever hear these lessons at these tables? Does this go on in Louisiana or only in the major cities? That you have to listen to these impossible parents. I never talk cute to the children. Okay, I'm a product of my upbringing. Harsh, Spartan-like. Don't be cute. I don't like cute. No jokes. Just get back to work. No matter what I did, I tried to entertain my... All right, get back to work. Stop the entertainment. He knew I was trying to, like, wiggle out of work by entertaining him. All right, that's very good. Now get back to work. No radio. On the way into work, I swear to God, if I was, like, driving in his car, I don't know how old I was. He didn't want the radio on. If I tried to put the radio on because it was horrible, sitting next to your father in a car on the way to work, it was going to be a horrible day in a disgusting market all day long, which I didn't want to do. I didn't want to go to begin with, but I didn't say anything. Okay, he needed me there. That was the way it was done. I didn't have any option anyway. It was like a little prison camp. But all right, so you sit in the right seat like a dummy, your hands folded on your lap, and nothing, not a word, mum. The whole ride. BQE, the Kosciuszko Bridge, the stink of the pork dying there, the Trun's Meat Market. Where the eye goes out, you think that you ran over a skunk, but there are no skunks in Williamsburg. That packing plant in August was enough. You talk about a weapon of mass destruction. The Trun's meat packing plant in Williamsburg, Brooklyn in the 50s was a WMD. That's why rents were low in those days. The floors were cockeyed with linoleum that when a dog would urinate in the bedroom, it would run into the living room.
because the floors were old. But that's the way it was. No one complained. Today you got the same losers who can't live in Manhattan. They live there now. They discovered the charm of Williamsburg. Oh, I really love it over here. It's really great. You know, it's right near the overpass, and I like the factory area. Nobody ever wanted to live there. Even when it was in its heyday, nobody wanted to live there. But the point I'm making is a little different. So if you sit in the car, you're next to your father driving to work, and you know you can't say anything. There's nothing to say. He's grim. He's white. His hands are white-knuckled on the wheel because he's gone in again another horrible day to make a living. Nothing was fun. Nobody worked in those days for fun. This was an evolution of the Dr. Spock generation. Oh, find what's fun and pursue it. Pursue what's fun. To my father, nothing was fun. It was grim. Horrible. It was like Grimm's fairy tales. Came over, work, drop dead, and move on. It's in the ground. In the ground. That's it. Next case. Next generation. There was no fun. From another world, they didn't know what the word fun was. So he's driving to work. The hands are like white knuckles. And I'm sitting here. So my hand reaches, the left hand reaches for the radio dial. Like to punch a button in. No, no radio. So what do you mean no radio? I don't want music. Why? Never mind why. This is not entertainment. It's work. So, all right. So work has to be torture. I get it. All right. That's why I'm in the radio business. I was made for this. What I'm getting at is he didn't like cute. If he saw people, and I'm the same way, unfortunately, I become him in essence. This is how it is. All the years I resisted becoming him, I came, a long time ago I became my father. I admit it. There must be something to it. Worked for him. It's worked for me so far. But he didn't like cute. People who talk cute to the children. You know, the guy was 100% right. Let's say I'm talking generally, 9 out of the 10 couples did not talk to their children in because it was like embarrassing. Anyone who did that, the child either wound up in San Francisco wearing a pink set of tights at 19 expressing himself, or the girl wound up married to her sorority sister. 9 out of 10, they never wound up okay. None of them became anything. That's true because of the liberal upbringing. Liberalism not only is a mental disorder, but destroys children. You need to raise children the old-fashioned way. I don't say hurt them. I never got hit. He didn't hit me. Just verbal abuse. It worked better.
You're listening to a collection of Michael Savage's personal stories today on the Savage Nation. Remember, tomorrow, January 2nd, I am live right here on this station.
Join the Savage Nation. Call now, 855-400-SAVAGE, 855-400-7282. Savage.
One of the best ways for you to get to know me is through my stories, my famous stories. Tippy the dog, he would let people in our house, but if you try to leave, he would rip you to shreds. So here's the story of Tippy the dog.
Now, Tippy the dog, we lived in a little house in Queens, New York when I was a boy. Tippy the dog would always let people in the house, but he would never let them out. Oh, you can come in, he wouldn't bark at all. He smiled, the tongue hung out. But if you try to leave, he attacked you. He went crazy, left at the throat. You had to constrain him like with an iron chain. Then put him in a basement. You'd hear broom things fall down the steps. And a door. I mean, he almost broke the door. For so he had a nut. He was like a nutcase dog.
Savage.
The story I'm going to tell you occurred when I was a young man. First a kid and then a young man. And it was about a man who grew up as one of my father's best friends in a very poor neighborhood in New York City. They were immigrants together. Their parents came over. They came over, I think, maybe on the same boat, or they met each other in the slums of New York. And they both had a very tough life, and they worked their way up little by little, as the immigrants have to do and as they struggle in the society. And this man went into a business that took off at a certain point like a rocket. He hit a fad in a certain business, and he started to make a great deal of money, and he moved way beyond our family. While we lived in an attached house in Queens, New York, an attached brick house. He had the money to move his family to a detached house. Remember how important that distinction was in those days. It's like the Buick LeSabre as opposed to the Buick Roadmaster. Well, God forbid you a Rockefeller, you bought a Cadillac, if you can imagine. That's how people used to grade themselves in those days by their status, cars and houses. I don't suppose it's much different today. It just isn't as easy to figure out in some regard, not on the road anyway. Anyway, so he moved to this detached house in Roslyn, New York. And it was a beautiful house. It had its own garden all around it. We only had a little strip of grass in the backyard, a little teeny one in the front. And
the carpet was wall to wall, and it was pink. And he was a big cigar smoker. And we go over and visit, and I had a very good time. He would gloat, you know, with the cigar and lord it over my father. And we'd leave. My father never said anything against him, but, you know, I could see in his eyes that he was in his, you know, he was a little, let's say lost that little battle at that time. You know how men are. I mean, men are competitive. Even if they love their friend, if their friend does better than them, there's a degree of envy in every human being. It's just one of the cardinal sins. As years went on, the man's business continued to thrive. And then I left home. I moved away from New York City. I went and did my thing collecting plants, working for my graduate degrees. Thousands of miles away. I was living 6,000 miles away, then 9,000 miles away in the Fiji Islands. And lo and behold, on one of my trips back to New York when I was already a father myself, I had heard that this man's business had collapsed entirely. The fad that he had rode like a wave had died. Women were no longer buying that particular product. And the man who had a chain of successful wholesale stores lost everything. He lost everything, and it was so fast that he wound up living where he started, on the Lower East Side of New York, in a poor relative's apartment with his wife and the relative's family, back where he started in a one-room apartment. And that's where I come in. I come back from one of my trips to the Fiji Islands. I'm a young man in my, I don't know how old I must have been. I don't remember, 25, 30. I don't remember what age I was already anymore. And there he was, sitting in my father's house. And I loved this man. I loved him like another father. I loved all my father's friends. And you know how it is when you're a kid in a very close-knit community. You tend to love the people like they're your own, you know. We all grew up so closely together. There was never a bad word between him and my father, man. He's sitting there, shrunken up in the chair in my living room, where he had lost everything. And he looks up at me, still smoking a cigar, and he was shrunken in the chair. And he looks up at me in his eyes, and he says, Michael, look what happened to me. Look what happened to me. And his eyes were like wandering left and right. He didn't understand what happened to him. And he said, I'd rather I have cancer than what God did to me. Lo and behold, I soon left New York. I went back to do what I did, which is collecting plants. And I heard that 2 years later he died from one of the most rapidly invasive forms of brain cancer. Be careful what you say. God hears the truth, but waits.
Savage. Now- Warning, the Savage Nation contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised. And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, the Savage Nation, home of borders, language, culture. And here he is, Michael Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of The Savage Nation.
Well, here we are, the kickoff day. Let's go downfield together on The Savage Nation in the daytime slot, the primetime slot, 3 to 6 Eastern, 12 to 3 Western, and everything in between. As you well know, today is the first day of the rest of my radio life. And since so many people are other-directed with sports and travel and entertainment, we've decided to give you the best of the best, the Savage family stories over the years today. But remember this, tomorrow, January 2nd, it will be live all day long. By the way, the New York Daily News did a fabulous article on yours truly, Civilized Savage. He knows the issues and museums and music too. Well, if you think that's all it's about, then you don't know Michael Savage. Sit back and relax and listen to the best of the Savage Nation live tomorrow. Louis the Bum, very popular subject. Here is the story about my good, good friend Louis the Bum and when he bought a monkey.
So it reminds me of Louis and the Monkey story, which I told once at most in my tenure on radio. We go back now, ladies and gentlemen, put on your resting cap. We're going to go back in time. We're going back to the Lower East Side of New York. Dad owns a small antiques mart. Little old Michael's cleaning bronzes in the back, and there's Louis the Bum from the Bowery, who in those days, he was a drunk. He wasn't a bum. He worked. Dad would have him in on the weekends, and he'd clean the bronzes and whatever he did down there. I loved Louis. Louis was a great guy. But now you got to understand, this guy was a stoned alcoholic of the old school. Skinny like a rail. White guy, skinny like a rail, smoked like unfiltered cigarettes, but one of the nicest guys on earth. He wears the rubber apron. He's cleaning downstairs, does the bronzes. Then, of course, I took over because Dad wanted cheap child labor, and where else are you going to get it from his son, you know? So I'm doing the thing. So I got to know Louis over the years, and he taught me various things. Like once we had Louis over to the house. I'll never forget it. I was so proud that my father took this guy who I liked all the way out to Queens and invited him to dinner. I don't know what came over. Maybe it was Thanksgiving or whatever. And Louis had dinner with us at the table, and the guy was surprisingly erudite, and he knew things. And, like, after dinner, we did games, and Louis the drunk showed me how to bend nails. He showed me mind over matter. He took a nail, and he showed me that if you put your fingers, blah, 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 and put your mind on it and keep up the pressure, the nail would bend. I was shocked because I was a skinny kid with little hands, and I bent the nail. And he taught me mind over matter, but it was all molecular because you put the heat and the pressure, blah, 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 eventually that nail is going to bend. But I learned in life it's the same thing. It's all willpower, okay? Now there's another element to the story. So Louis is this kind of guy, interesting but an alcoholic, and this and that. Years go by. He lives alone in Williamsburg. In those days, Williamsburg was like a slum, zero, you know, oilcloth city, leftover apartments from the last century. No one wanted to be there but the poor. So he lives there alone. He's very lonely. He gets a monkey. He wants a monkey. Now, out of the world, nobody in those days had a monkey. Dogs, yes. Cats, yes. Nope. Who had a monkey in those days? Louis gets a monkey. But Louis don't just get a spider monkey, one of the skinny little monkeys. Louis gets a woolly monkey. Now, woolly monkeys are already strong. They got a chest on them. They got strong hands. And Louis's in love with this monkey. For a couple of months, they're inseparable. Wherever he goes, there's the monkey. And the monkey's on his shoulder and where he's cleaning and he's happy. Now, Louis was the kind of guy that if he went to a bar on the Lower East Side, I remember the name to this day, named Hamill and Corn. Whatever money he made from my father, he'd take 2 minutes later, he'd be in the bar, and he'd throw money in a jukebox, and he would whistle and sing, and he'd buy everyone drinks till he was broke. He'd stumble out in the street, he would get hit by a car, sleep on a barrel, he didn't care, live for the booze, and that was it, but he had a heart of gold. So Louis gets the monkey, finally has someone to fill his empty nights, and as I say, they were inseparable. Well, as time went on, we get a call, Louis's in the hospital, he's dying. What? The monkey went crazy in his apartment, attacked him, and almost ripped him to pieces. And he suffered for 6 months in the hospital. I don't know which hospital, probably Bellevue, because that's where they all wound up. And the monkey went at him, and you don't know what a monkey's like when it goes crazy. You try to stop an enraged monkey without a weapon. He ripped his neck, he ripped his face, he ripped his arms, he ripped his leg, he ripped his crotch, he ripped his behind. Louis was ripped up pretty bad, and eventually, he took the monkey, I think he grabbed it and threw it out of the window. Oh, it just shows you, if he hadn't have done it, he'd be dead today, okay? But a liberal today probably would have tried to talk to the monkey. Louis knew that the instincts had to kick in. It was him or the monkey, and he decided it was better him than the monkey. He didn't consult a liberal book on how to deal with a crazed monkey. He just fought with it and killed it. I think that's what the bottom line is here. But the point is that even a lonely drunk needs companionship at night. In his case, he found the monkey. It was probably the right thing for him to do. So right now you could see that Louis was a pioneer in a way, in the sense that he understood that monkeys were dangerous long before they did in India when they turned into a sacred animal. And that's the Louis and the monkey story.
Savage.
I wandered the streets of San Francisco feeling the cool air on my face, wondering when global warming would descend upon the city. I was glad it hadn't because I really still enjoy the winters here. I had watched the Queen Mary sail. It was unbelievable. This was a behemoth. I thought only of the Titanic. I mean, this is like the new Titanic, this ship. Unfortunately for me, I can no longer pine for ships because I've spent so many years doing so when I was a kid in New York and penniless. I used to drive on the West Side Highway and look at the great ships of the time lining up on the piers on the Hudson River and dream that when I was a young man, when I would be a young man, I'd get the money and I would take ship trips. And I did. I did a lot of them. I was always in love with the sea. And then I was married. Then I had children. Then I went up with them and everybody, took everybody to the South Seas. I did a lot of adventurous things when I was young. And I got a lot of the ocean liner thing out of my system, but I got to tell you, ocean liners of that day and cruise ships of today are two different birds. They're much different. When I would go in the 60s, for example, on the P&O liner, the Oriana, I mean, I'm going to tell you, that was not a cruise line. It was used for transport. In those days, the P&O lines, actually, tickets were given for free as part of the compensation package to British civil servants. So, for example, if they were serving in Australia or New Zealand, I think they got a once annual free passage back to the home country of England
on the P&O liner. So the ships were used for passage, not so much as a cruise line, and it was a very big difference. The British were also very big on class differential, as they still are, much to their detriment, I think. And so you had a true first class, a true tourist class, and a true, I guess, passage class or whatever it was. And at that time, I was a young graduate student or a young anthropologist or a lecturer. And I'll never forget making friends with some royal of some kind, a lower-level royal. He was a British Air Force officer. They always liked me. I always liked them. And he invited me up to first class. It was as though I stepped into another world. We sat in the drawing room, and we drank, and we talked, and whatever. And it was great fun. He made a mockery of the class differential. I guess he liked the fact that I was kind of a bohemian to him and an anthropologist that was real and bored out of his gourd up there in first class listening to the chatter. But today is a different world. So anyway, to make a long story short, I watched the Queen Mary leave last night. And by the way, I was looking at it with my very powerful marine binoculars. These are the best. There's some German glasses that I was using. And I could see the people on the deck, you know, and saying goodbye. I didn't really wish I was there drinking and looking forward to X number of days eating and drinking and drinking and eating and eating and drinking and drinking and eating and eating and drinking and drinking and eating. I guess I can't do it. Now, if you, on the other hand, have never done it, you should do it because the ships are amazing. That's if you really, you know, go out of the cabin and go out on the deck at night. I mean, you're in for some quite an experience if you look at the sea. I remember, and I don't want to go into the long story, I remember the longest ship trip between ports that I ever took was the Royal Viking Sea. It departed Long Beach, and it took 10 days to reach the Marquesas Islands. No, I think the first port of call was Tahiti, excuse me. It was the longest, it was 10 straight days without land, and I remember that before we reached Tahiti, I stayed up all night drinking red wine by myself. And I wrote a poem. God, I wish I could find it. I don't know what I did with it. I have all of my stuff in a warehouse somewhere all of those days. I was a different person in those days. But, you know, you're never really a different person. It was just another phase of my life. But here's the point of it. And forgive me if I'm wandering a little bit. I'm just a little fed up with politics for the moment. I stayed up all night. I put on the best clothing I had. The family went to sleep. I got the best and most expensive bottle of red wine I could buy at the time on the ship. And I stayed up all night drinking by myself because as we were approaching land after 10 days at sea, I could smell the land as we approached it. I have a very keen sense of smell. I'm very lucky in some cases, unless I enter the U.S. House of Representatives during July. And I could smell the sweet water on the landmass as it started to appear from the distance. And I remember writing about the smell of sweet water after 10 days at sea. I wish I could find it. God, and now I'm getting nostalgic for that particular trip. I wish I could be back on it, but you can't turn the clock back, can you? My only hope is that there really is time travel. My only hope is that the distance to the stars is real. My only hope is that one day we will actually understand that there is eternity. And one day, from eternity, we can look back and step back into our lives at any point and maybe, just maybe, change things just slightly and change, therefore, the course of our lives.
Savage.
You're listening to a collection of Michael Savage's personal stories today on the Savage Nation. Remember, tomorrow, January 2nd, I am live right here on this station.
Join the Savage Nation. Call now, 855-400-SAVAGE, 855-400-7282. Savage.
Hot Talk 560 KSFO.
Woodchuck Bill. Many of you remember Woodchuck Bill. And people ask for this story all the time. Well, here it is. When I was a kid, every summer, I love the summer. What kid didn't? Because in those days, you didn't go to summer school. You didn't go to a camp to advance your mathematical knowledge, another to advance your sports knowledge, another to lose your tubby waist. You went and had fun for the whole summer. And we were kind of poor, so what we did was, to get out of the hot inner city, the family rented a small cottage with all the other families from the neighborhood and relatives,
up in the cool mountains called the Catskill Mountains, and they were known as bungalow colonies because you got basically a one-room, kitchen, bedroom, bathroom, boom. And your whole family was in there, but they were like, all, the whole thing was filled with your friends and their parents, so it became like a little village. Naturally, it was paradise because every other parent was your parent, and you reverted back to like another time in history, so it was wonderful. We'd play Indians out in the woods, and we'd carve trees and make canoes. God knows what we did. So in one of these places, there was a guy who was a caretaker who lived in an old abandoned barn with his wife, believe it or not. And he mowed the lawn. He had the hammer, fixed the hammer. His name was Woodchuck Bill. And us kids, it was like a Tom Sawyer thing. We loved Woodchuck Bill. Kids loved. Now, remember, he was not a bum. See, today they're bum. They're homeless. He was what was known as a hobo in those days. And there were people who were hobos. They were sort of respectable in their own way. That was his job category. It was like hobo. He would put it on the IRS. Like, what do you do? Job category, hobo. I don't know what he made, next to nothing. But he lived up in this, as I say, ramshackle barn-like structure with his, he had a wife, actually. And Woodchuck Bill would regale us kids with his stories. And he was a big guy with a big stomach on him. So the story begins with him saying, all right, kids, come over here. Today they probably arrest him for molestation, just for even telling us a story. Some freak would arrest him. He says, all right, I want all of you to punch me in the stomach. Now, right away, that's rape today. It's raping a child in some way. So we'd all go up with our skinny little arms. We're 9, 8, 7, and punch him in the stomach, and nothing would happen. So naturally, we thought he was Superman. He must have been pretty strong, I mean, if you think about it, because they're 8-year-old kids that can give you quite a belt, even today. Anyway, so we all hit him, and we realized we were nothing compared to Woodchuck Bill. Then we'd sit at his feet, and he would tell us stories. He'd say, well, I've seen hurricanes, and I've seen tornadoes. Well, we sat spellbound, like really out of a book from the 19th century. So what I liked most about Woodchuck Bill was that he lived in this barn with almost nothing. He had his few pots and pans, him and a wife, and they hung from like hooks over the thing and actually cooked in there. But he said he used to eat woodchucks. We'd say, Bill, what do you eat? He said, we eat woodchucks. Who knows if he's telling the truth? I don't know if you can eat a woodchuck. And that's the Woodchuck Bill story. I mean, you wanted something more to it. There is nothing more. That's a jazz story. You got to understand jazz music to understand that story. It ends like boom, and the horn goes down. That's it. But unless you understand how jazz works, you're not going to be, like, satisfied because you want a beginning, a middle, and an end. And then Bill raped us, and he was taken away by Child Protective Services, and we lived miserably ever after. No, it didn't happen that way. Today they'd arrest him for just being Woodchuck Bill. They'd give him treatment. They put him on a pill. And he'd probably go berserk and kill people on the IRT, throw him on a third rail when the pill wore off.
Savage.
Have you heard the story of the half-man, half-woman who came into my father's antique store? Well, you're going to hear it now. I got to tell a half-man, half-woman story in Long Beach. I'm not talking about the supervisors of San Francisco. I'm talking about a long time ago in New York City. Dad had a small antique store. I told you he sold clocks and figures and statues, mainly 19th century French, and some of it was very good. So amongst the many customers, one of them was a circus performer in the freak show of Ringling Brothers who would get up there, half man, half woman. I don't know, he had a breast on one side and the other side he didn't. I don't know how they with a half a beard. But, you know, after work, he was a regular person, and he lived in a house in Long Beach, like one of those little Godfather houses. So Dad would deliver the work after work. He delivered his own, you know, sales. He didn't have a delivery boy. And I would, you know, I was the kid. I'd go along on the ride, whether it would be the DeSoto or the Cadillac Model 62 with the statues in the back. And we'd pull up late at night because this guy didn't like to come out during the day. I'll never forget this as long as I live. So the circus guy, the half man, half woman, ring, ring, who's there? Blah, blah, blah. So the guy opens the door, but he can't open the door all the way. He can only open it a crack. And he has to, like, pull the door and push stuff to get. And the house is now littered with art objects in no particular order. Hundreds of statues and paintings on the floor, nothing hung right. He would buy one beautiful thing after another and just randomly put it on the floor like a warehouse. And what was that? Nobody knew. I knew. I was a kid who thought on those long rides out to Long Island and the long rides back, those long winter nights over the Williamsburg Bridge in the car with the sound of the grated
metal underneath the tire as your car went over it, looking down from the childhood at the ships that came back from the Korean War with the painting of the LST in the Brooklyn Navy Yard. All the way through to this, I figured out what it was. This guy was a freak. He was ugly in his own mind. So he compensated for his ugliness by buying beauty. And he needed to surround himself with beautiful things as much as possible in a compulsive way. I did not go into psychiatry because I did not want to subject myself to people's problems. But trust me, I know exactly what people are all about, including the half man, half woman in Long Beach.
Remember, tomorrow, I am live right here on this station.
Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of The Savage Nation.
Here's a story not to laugh at. It's about the Nympho in Alley Pond Park. The Nympho in Alley Pond Park on The Savage Nation.
So you see, I was about 16 years old, Queens, New York, and one of the girls in the crowd was, she was that way, she was a nymphomaniac. It was a cold winter's evening. A group of five or six guys took her in a car to Alley Pond Park, and they had their way with her. I was one of the guys in the car, and I did not want my way with her. In fact, I felt bad for her. I didn't know what to do. I was like, I was the idiot, sensitive kid in the back who was laughed at. Like, hey, it's your turn. I said, no, I just don't want to do this. Something's wrong here. So after the guys, these pigs, these animals, most of whom wound up working in the garment center, selling clothing. Some, I think, went into the television business. One went into the record business. Got through with her. The car went back to her house. And here's the whole crux of the story. It's not like laughing about the nymphomaniac in the car. Here's the crux of the story. Car pulls up back in front of her house. And she lived in a nice house. And her father's waiting for her on the lawn of the house with an overcoat. The guys basically throw her out of the car, disheveled and like half naked, laughing, and speed away. And I turn around and see the father walking up to her to cloak her and cover her nakedness with the overcoat. Now, there's so much in that story that needs to be discussed. What a father. What a great father he was. Now, you'd think a father would scream, you filthy slut, you, blah, 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 how dare you? Or he'd come at the car and hit the guys. He didn't do either, did he? He lived with what was. He knew who his daughter was and what her proclivities were. I don't know how she wound up. I mean, maybe she turns out. A lot of people go through these phases. And they, you know, in the woman's side, you know, can straighten out. I mean, I don't know what they become. Maybe a yoga instructor or something later on in life. Or if they're a male and they suffer from satiriasis, they become a president. Like Bill Clinton, you know, if they suffer the equivalent of nymphomania in male, it's satiriasis, and that can make you into a wonderful president in some cases. But in either case, that's the story of the nymphomaniac at Alley Pond Park. That goes with the song which we're going to play right now on the way out. The Only Have Eyes for You song, Springland, New York. Oh, no, wait a minute. Play the song. But that goes with the girl next to the sewer plant.
I can't see anyone.
That's right, there was a runner-up to Nympho story. I don't know what song goes with that.
Savage.
Now here's a true childhood story that I may have told once in 15 years of radio. Barry Schmaltz and his crazy mother Betty Schmaltz and his father Louis Schmaltz. The names have been changed to protect the Schmaltzes. Let's see, how do I begin the story? He was about 15 years old. He was a tall kid. His bedroom, pink carpet, two-story house, nice house. He's having a fist fight with his father in the bedroom over something his mother said. It ends with him crying and enraged because he knew he could beat the heck out of his father after a few real good punches were thrown. I don't know if you've ever seen a father and son fight. It's actually heartbreaking to see. To me, it was a violation of a very deeply held taboo, never to strike your father no matter what. Well, I don't know, but that family was crazy from top to bottom. They went at each other with straight rights and blasted each other, and it ended with the kid holding his punches because I think he could have really knocked his father on his butt. He picked up a piggy bank that to me was like, looked like a 25-pound piggy bank that he had, a ceramic one, since I knew him for 10 years. And he was enraged and red-faced and tears running down his eyes. He looked at his father, and he smashed the piggy bank on the floor, and all the coins that he had collected since childhood was smashed. And then the father threw him out of the house, and he wound up living in my mother's basement for a little while.
Now, I don't know this guy anymore, but let me tell you what happened that day. Here's what happened that day. His mother was a would-be, like, movie star, as many women were in the 50s. They were always trying to be like either, not Marilyn Monroe, but there were some buxom movie, like Jane Mansfield, more like that type. Cadillac, the platinum blonde hair, always showing off. The father was a worker, gray-faced. He'd come home gray-faced from his job. He owned a little wholesale milk business. So they were a little better off than us somehow. But she had the Cadillac, the Coupe de Ville, pink one. And a whack job, nuts, out of her mind. Why? She was always trying to lose weight. She went to some doctor in New Jersey who put her on Benzedrine or some kind of amphetamines, which gave her a madness, a Benny high. And so she comes home, crazy out of her mind, and she takes a dog chain and beats her wrist till it bleeds just before the father comes in at dark, at dusk, ashen-faced from the day in the milk plant. And she says, Louie, 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 look what your rotten son did to me. Look what he did to my hands. Well, Louie, the father, naturally would be protective of his wife. He runs upstairs and screams to the kid, Barry, what did you do to your mother? And the kid says, I didn't do anything. I didn't do anything. You liar, you. And that's when they fought. So from the crazy mother, Betty Schmaltz, who turned Louie against Barry. Now, you say drug usage is prevalent today. Let me tell you something. There's plenty of drug usage in those glorious Eisenhower days, but it was Sub Rosa drug usage. Half the women were either on Miltown or on Benzedrine for diet. Miltown was prescribed then as Prozac, let's say, as today. You know, a lot of kids came home from college and used a little Miltown with rosé wine, Meduse rosé. They got a nice buzzeroo during the afternoons when the mother wasn't home. So I'm telling you, that's the Schmaltz story. It's a sad story. And the kid wound up basically a bug all his life. He was never stable. Well, I haven't seen him in many years, but he was a good friend of mine, but he's not a reliable friend when a kid can't rely upon his mother or his father, he winds up to be an unreliable person in life 99% of the time. He winds up to be someone you can't count on because he can never count on somebody else.
Savage.
How about a personal story, human interest story now in the middle of all of this? It's quite interesting. It'll take me 1 minute or less because there's an interesting point, and it begins with a staple cut. I had to go to the laboratory this morning for a medical test, for blood test that I've been putting off for at least 4 weeks. Every day I stared at the form, you know, and I wouldn't go. Every day I stared at it and said, I got to go tomorrow and make sure when I get up, don't eat anything, don't take anything with the blood, the lipids and the schmipids. So I put it off every day, but I made up my mind today was going to be the day. I go down the driveway in the morning in the bathrobe to get the paper. I pick it up, take it out of its blue wrapper, and I try to rip something off from the paper, and I cut my finger on a staple which said, Merry Christmas, my name is Jose. Can you please leave me a gift in this envelope? So my finger bled. I said, oh, my God, what a bad start to the day this is going to be. You know, you give the newspaper guy some money. The guy comes in the middle of the night. Why not? You throw him a $20 bill, a $50. Who knows what we give him? I don't know. We put in the envelope. I never stiff anybody. I know what it's like to be almost a slave in this country. I go to the thing. I get the butterfly, the six things, the six vials of blood that come out of me. I never felt better. I'll tell you, there may be something to bloodletting that we have to look into. I have a doctor friend who's very healthy, who's an orthomolecular physician, who bleeds himself on a regular basis. And he swears it's a very healthful thing to do. So I said, well, what's your theory about bleeding yourself? Why is it a healthful thing to do? And he said, well, for one, it removes the iron from a man's blood to a certain extent. As you well know, iron can be somewhat toxic with regard to coronary artery disease. And I said, well, what's the natural evidence that you have? He said, well, it's very simple, Michael. He said, throughout history, in primitive times, mankind had to hunt, mankind had to fight, and often he bled. And he bled small amounts of blood on a fairly regular basis, whether he was hunting in the brush and cutting himself with the brush or in a fight with an animal or a fight with another human being, he bled. And it was good for him. And now if a drop of blood comes out of our body, we scream and go to the doctor and get, Bactine on it. We spray ourselves. It's an interesting thought, just related to the newspaper, the driveway, and the staple. and I thought I would share it with you.
Savage.
I'll give you my idea of where I'm going with restaurants lately. I am so fed up with restaurants, I'm becoming a total hermit. Last night I went right home after the radio show, stormy, windy, this, that. I simply boiled. I'm getting to be like an old Italian. I'm not even old, and I'm not an Italian. I used to see old Italians do this. I thought they were crazy when I was young. I would notice that at the end of the night, he didn't eat veal parmesan. He didn't eat a spumoni. You know what he ate? He boiled spaghetti with nothing on it. I thought he was nuts. And you know what I made last night? Boiled spaghetti with some parmesan cheese and some fresh ground black pepper. I swear to God, after I got through eating it and watching TV, I smacked my lips and I said, my God, that was delicious. No oil, no oleo. No, none of the oleo with garlic number. I didn't need a total indigestion and insomnia. I knew I was going to have insomnia anyway. I didn't need to go with it, a little indigestion. Plain noodles with fresh grated cheese and some fresh pepper. It was unbelievable to me how good it tasted. So my tastes are changing. I'm not putting down restaurants. I tried to get it once. They wouldn't serve it to me. I said, you're charging $16.95 for a bowl of spaghetti. I don't mind. I'm here for the ambience. I know you got to make a buck. Give me a plate of spaghetti. No oil, no sauce. The guy says, what? I said, no sauce, no oleo, oilio, no garlic and oilio. I don't want it with your rancid garlic from underneath the rat poison area of the kitchen. Just the plain noodle. Do me a favor. Then they do another thing. They give me spaghetti that you can't digest. Al dente. Who came up with that? Who came up with that nonsense? Al dente. I ask for el softe when I ask for pasta. For the last 5 years, they give it to me al softe because I can't take al dente. Al dente gives me a bente in the stomach. I can't eat it. You know why they came up with al dente? They boil it for half the amount of time, and you, the moron, eat it. Oh, yeah, that's how they eat it in all the old world. Because they're cheap. They didn't want to cook it for the full 11 minutes. They cook it for five, and you, the American schmuck, you'll eat it even though it's as hard as a rock. And like, oh, yeah, that was terrific. It was very authentic. At al dente, al dente. I said, I want it so soft that it's almost falling apart in the plate. That's all. You know, at a certain point in your life, you have to have the courage of your own tastes and your own convictions. So I'm that kind of guy. If I want al softy, I get al softy. I want no sauce, I get no sauce. I'm not ashamed to ask for it. I'm paying for it. I didn't ask for a discount. I didn't say give me just spaghetti and take off for the sauce. I wouldn't do that. I have pride, you know.
Remember, tomorrow, live, right here on your local station, the first of the new Savage Nation.
Savage.
Have you ever... When pasta was spaghetti, maybe one of my most requested pieces ever. We had to include this for you.
Playing Italian music because I have a treat for you. I found the poem When Pasta Was Spaghetti in my archives. It was written, let's see, Michael Savage, August 1985, written in a lightning storm at 40,000 feet over Cheyenne, Wyoming. When I thought the plane was going to crash, I wrote When Pasta Was Spaghetti. So here it is, whether you like it or not, all right? So you liberals get ready to sneer, and you sane people get ready to enjoy it because it's a wonderful poem. So play the music again. Go ahead. We got the mood set up. It's called When Pasta Was Spaghetti. And try to imagine it, all right? The hairy forearms of New York serve you your coffee with a turning gesture, an offering that says drink, eat, enjoy. The wiry Italian in Vincent's clam bar, the one behind the greased over register, the young kid connected who receives his deference from the spaghetti cook older than his gangster father, the spaghetti cook who looks like an old-fashioned doctor from the Bronx with clipped mustache. He actually pulls some noodles out of the pot and eats them as they cook, looking to the grimy ceiling for his tender answer. Well, they used to call it spaghetti. Now it's pasta at $10 a plate. The smoky windows of Romeo's Spaghetti now offers radios and knickknacks. It was 50 cents a plate then, in neon letters that you couldn't miss, even through a fogged-over window on a cold winter's eve. There was life. Marinara sauce that smacked to the sea. Noodles as long as your young arm. Meatballs as fluffy as your dream of them. Bread on the table you'd eat against your parents' admonitions that the meal was coming, the meal was coming. And men, some burly with black hairy forearms whose smile scared you, and little skinny guys with the look of murder on their faces, and people who slurped their spaghetti straight to their mouths from the plate, one motion like Chinese shoveling rice at mouth with clicking sticks. That was gusto before it became a beer ad. That was taste before it became a synonym for fashion. That was spaghetti before it became pasta. Play the music, basta. Very good. I'll do that for private readings for $100,000 for my favorite charity, which is the Poor Revere Society. You want me at your party? You want me at your party? I'll come and read a pasta with spaghetti. What if I actually had a gangster call me up? Like, all right, Mike, we want you to come read that pasta with spaghetti. I'll give you 100 grand, nothing to us. I would do it. I would do it for 10 grand, let's say. I read that Chicken Behind gets $1 million per private performance. Could you believe this? The guy started as a street mime in San Francisco. $1 million, they say, gets for personal performance at someone's party. Unbelievable. I mean, there is a price at which you'll be a clown. That's all. That got me through my 18th year when I thought I was too good for anything. You ever go through that? That's how a lot of people wind up bums. They're too good to do anything, so they wind up doing nothing. They wind up living in their parents' house smoking dope, but they're waiting to, you know, be discovered. Everyone's got to sell out. You just got to, you know, just sell out for the highest price you can. That's the whole story.
Savage.
Let me just tell a 30-second dog story because it's amazing. I said, what could I tell the people that they'd enjoy about the dog? Well, it's just that. I come home. It's the same every night. He gets so crazy. And, you know, dogs are beautiful. I've always had dogs who get excited when they're young. But this one is different. He runs. And you ever see a rabbit run down a pasture? How every number of steps he leaps like with a hop? That's what Teddy does. He has a hop in him. I don't know where the hop came from. He's more rabbit than dog in a way. He runs and then throws himself up with a little hop and tugs at my clothing like in a comic book. And in the beginning, I'd say, Teddy, stop. You're going to rip my clothing. You know what I've come to? I say, Teddy, go ahead, rip my clothing. I don't even care. I let my arms hang down. He can rip my pants. He can rip my... Yeah, he doesn't mean to rip it. He's just trying to say hello. And he keeps going and going and going till he starts to wheeze. I have to stop him, and I have to grab him. I'm afraid the dog's going to, like, stroke out from excitement. But you know what? Why I don't stop him anymore? I'll tell you why. Because I know one day he'll be old, and one day he won't be able to run, and he won't be motivated to run anymore, like my other dog, Snowy. She can hardly move. So I said, if this is what he is now... Then enjoy it. Enjoy his joy, because in what, 5 years, 6 years, 8 years, whatever it may be, assuming that the earth doesn't melt down because of Al Gore's hot air, the dog won't be able to do it. And what, I'll look back and say, my God, I remember when you were little, Teddy, and you used to run in the driveway until you almost got a stroke and jump and nip at me? Yeah, so you see, you're lucky if you could look forward and see the future, because sometimes it can help you enjoy the present more.
Remember, tomorrow, January 2nd, I am live right here on this station.